Professor Letterman, thank you for giving this interview to Eurasia Journal. And I would like to talk with you about the past, present, and future of the nature of science research within the field of science education, because it might have existed in philosophy,
okay.
Surely, but that's what I'm thinking. Now, my first question is, what marked the beginning of interest and research nature of science, as far as the science educators
okay,
are concerned.
I've tracked back all the way back to 1907. It was the first time I saw it referenced.
1907.
Yeah, and it was a journal put out by the Central Association of Education or something, a small group, but there was an article in 1907 that was talking about nature of science being important for students. It was, and their definition then was more like inquiry than what we've been doing now. But
at what level they were thinking?
They were talking about high school students, and they basically said high school graduates should know this. So I don't know when they started it, but there wasn't any real research though until I would say 1963 is when it really started. There was a study.
63.
1963. There was a study in 1957 that was actually done by Margaret Mead. She was writing for Science Magazine, and was more of students' perceptions of scientists. It was more like they draw a scientist test. But in 63 is when Kulium Klopper started asking the question about whether we were doing a good job of teaching nature or science or not, because it had been a curriculum goal. Mm-hmm. They developed the TUS exam, TOUS, testing something of understanding of science. What does it even stand for? Test on understanding of science, TUS. And they used that to see whether students understood nature or science, and they found out that they did not. And so that was the beginning of a lot of people doing research. And initially it was studying students, and then they started studying teachers, found out that the teachers didn't have a good understanding. And so they felt that, okay, if teachers don't understand it, how could you expect students to understand it? And so then people spent a lot of time thinking about teaching nature or science to teachers. And so there were curriculum projects that were out there, professional development, sometimes these worked, sometimes they didn't. There was also a lot of curriculum development.
Yeah.
And they found that certain curriculum were effective, a lot were not. But they found that even in the curriculum that was effective, with one teacher it worked, another teacher it did not work. And so they then, you know, said, like we always do, the teacher must be important. But at that point in time, rather than focusing on what the teacher did, they just stayed focused on the teacher knowledge. And I think at that time that put things back a bit, because the assumption still was that if a teacher knew it, somehow the students would know it. And so I would have, back then, focused on helping teachers teach it. But they just focused on getting teachers to understand it. There was a guy named John Trent in about 1966 wrote an article and said the teacher was important and we should work more with showing teachers how to teach nature of science, and nobody paid attention to it. But he said something, you know, 30 years, 40 years ago that we're now paying attention to now. Mm-hmm. The assumption for up until the early 80s was that a teacher's understanding automatically influenced students' understanding. A teacher's understanding influenced their teaching behavior. In 83, in my dissertation, I studied whether there was a relationship between students and teachers, and it showed there was not a relationship. The correlation was about 0.2. And that was the first study I know that actually tested that assumption. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, articles would begin with, it's assumed that a teacher's understanding affects their teaching.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to find in that study things that did influence students, but the things that influenced students were not necessarily related to the teacher's understanding of nature of science. So that eventually led to studies where people were looking at how do you still get teachers to understand, but then you also, how do you teach them to teach it to students?
Mm-hmm.
People assumed another second bad assumption, that if kids did science, that was the best way to teach nature or science. And so they were teaching teachers to get their students involved in doing science, which is not a bad thing, but there was never any explicit attention to nature or science. So the kids did the investigations, learned whatever they learned from that, but they didn't do well on nature or science because it wasn't really taught. So that second assumption was one that myself and my colleagues started looking at in terms of the explicit, implicit approach. And we found, and it's pretty well established now, that teaching it explicitly is much more effective than implicitly. If you don't do it explicitly, some kids in the class, there's always some kids in the class that think about these things, would pick it up. But pretty much you have to address it like you address anything else you want students to learn.
And at the beginning, with what elements of nature of science they began?
Tentativeness was always a big one. Subjectivity was in there. And those were the two big ones. There was nothing mm-hmm. about theory and law.
Mm-hmm.
There was nothing about social, cultural embeddedness. There was creativity was never really mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been there implicitly, but it really wasn't. And then there were a lot of things about the characteristics of scientists. You know, were they smarter than the regular population?
Hardworking,
those kinds of things, and things that were today we'd more look at it like in terms of how well a kid identifies with being a scientist and whether they could be a scientist.
How was the gender issue there?
There was not much in gender at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm trying to recall.
I'm
right
emphasizing
now.
For both genders doing science.
Oh yeah. But I don't know of any research that was out there then that in the beginning that was looking at do males or females view nature or science differently. The assessments, you know, the pictures were always pictures of males,
mm-hmm.
you know, that looked crazy and that kind of thing.
For teaching kids, for becoming a scientist,
mm-hmm.
do you think both genders were encouraged equally?
No, they weren't. Now, that wasn't in the nature of science research, but in the history of science education, we pretty much, you know, always felt the males could do well in this. It wasn't a female job. Teachers paid more attention in science classes to males. Whether they were doing well or not, they got more feedback, they got more attention. And many teachers, I mean, early on, outright just told girls that were interested in science or math that they should consider something else. I mean, this happened very recently. I mean, when I was a graduate student at Syracuse, and this was like in 79, Ann Howe was there, and her graduate background before she went to science education was in chemistry. And she had just gotten a master's degree in chemistry. She always told the story. And she wanted to go on to get a PhD in chemistry. She had her major professor write her a letter to get accepted somewhere. But in the letter, the major professor wrote that because she was female, she probably shouldn't become a chemist. And she found out about this some way. And so she didn't get in. But then she became a science educator. And she was very interested early in her career about gender issues because she had been the victim of that kind of thing.
I understand.
And so now my wife Judy, when she got her graduate degree in, when she was in graduate school in physics, was constantly told by her professors that this is not a thing for females.
Yeah.
So
maybe you'll be surprised to hear that, but like female scientists have a good portion in Turkey.
Mm-hmm.
Like many people, when they hear, they get somehow surprised. Mm-hmm. But like, and I don't think we had a big issue since the beginning of Republic in 1923.
Mm-hmm.
We have been doing a lot better, I guess.
One of the things I'll talk about at the plenary, I mean, one of the findings in terms of how science is taught in general is still, even though we talk about, the phrase that is in that literature base is culturalist or diverse views, so just having a more inclusive view of science, but the way it's still typically taught
mm-hmm.
is, you know, white, male, traditional,
yeah.
and so it's still there, it hasn't gone away.
Yeah.
That implicit message is
but
still there.
Having said that, I want to add one more thing. Like, If you see a female bus or truck driver in Turkey, like people will get shocked, I mean, the Turkish people. But for a scientist, it's okay. Female people, like they can be doctors, scientists, like
In the professions, it's okay. Okay.
How did the NOS research evolve during the past several decades, and what role do you think you played in it?
Well, I think like I was saying before, the initial were assessments of students and then eventually teachers, just describing, do students know these things that we want to know? And then when they didn't, they started looking at the teachers. And then they saw that nobody knew it. They tried to develop ways then to get students to know it. It was a big curriculum push, which didn't really work. And then when focused on teachers with that curriculum, sometimes the curriculum worked with one teacher but not another. That put a major emphasis on teachers, but it was down the track of teachers' knowledge. We then realized that we could not assume that just because the teacher knew nature of science, it would affect their classroom behavior. So there was an effort to affect teachers' behavior in the classroom, and that led to the explicit place where we're at right now. During that same period of time, there was a big evolution of how we assess nature of science. It started with traditional multiple choice kinds of exams, true and false exams. The big one was a TUS exam, which was multiple choice. And then the next big one was the WISP, which was the Wisconsin Inventory of Science Processes, and its variation called SPI, or Science Process Inventory. And these were like 125 true-false questions that were developed in Wisconsin. And then slowly, with time, people realized that these multiple choice, true and false, missed a lot. And people began to get to more open-ended kinds of things. Eventually following those with interviews. In terms of the change in assessments, I think my research group led the way with that. It was interesting because we were using these open-ended paper and pencil followed by a questionnaire as part of our research. And right about that time, there were people in the science ed community that were talking about developing a standardized nature of science test. And I remember that myself, Randy Bell, and Fuad were talking in Lake Como at the History of Philosophy meeting. And because Bill McComas and Ron Good were the two people talking about developing a test, which we thought was not good because they would lose a lot. And I remember saying to Randy and Fuad, I said, you know, we already have instruments. We just don't call them that. It's what we've been doing in our research. I think we should just go to a meeting and say, we have instruments. Here they are. And we went to it was the AETS meeting. I don't know the exact year, I could probably figure it out. And we just did a session and we said we had the instruments. That's when we named it the VNOS. And that's how it had happened. And so we led the way with that. And there were many different versions of the VNOS and now the VOSI for inquiry. We found that we don't have to interview everybody anymore because we've done it, we've used them so often. We know exactly how to interpret the students' responses, where initially we didn't. But we still interview because we find out things anyway. But there still is a push to develop instruments by some people, and we're actually starting to work with the research group from Essen in Germany with these competency models, which they say they can use to help develop a more efficient, in terms of time and administration, test of nature of science. So we're working with them. I don't think they can do it, but if they do, it'll be great. It'll be a great addition. I think that I was responsible for the movement from implicit to explicit. I think I was responsible
In
for the
terms of teaching,
in terms of teaching nature of science. I think that I was a leader in terms of the change in how we assessed it. I think in terms of activities that you actually can use in professional development teachers, we published a whole bunch that just came from our general practice, but then we formalized them. So I think if you go back and if you go back, you go into nature science literature, most of the publications that are empirical publications are from myself and my students, my former students. A lot of people write about philosophically about nature of science. Rick Duchel would be one that writes a lot. But he typically doesn't do research on nature of science. So if you look at the people that are doing the research, my group has been primarily the ones out there and probably guiding a lot.
Who you said?
Oh, my group?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it would be me, Fouad Abdelkhali, Randy Bell, Renee Schwartz, Valerie Ackerson, and they've gone out by themselves and done a whole bunch. So it's that small clique that's done a lot of the empirical stuff. We're not the only ones, but the majority has been by us. So.
Yep. Are you happy with the current status of nature of science research? That is, did we come a long way? And what was it like? I mean,
I'm happy with the progress we've made. I'm not happy with the status of nature of science in terms of if you go around to classrooms around the world, you still don't see it happening.
Mm. In the textbooks?
No. You'll see a section of textbooks, it'll say nature of science in chapter one, but it's talking more about, and this is a problem with the wording too, but it'll talk more about what scientists do, more like inquiry, and how is science different than some other disciplines. And I think what happened, and I put it in the chapter in the handbook, that at the very beginning, when I first started getting interested in nature of science, I had read an article by Peter Ruba. And it was about 1975, 76, and he was calling it the nature of scientific knowledge. And he had an instrument called the nature of scientific knowledge, NSK at scale. And somewhere along the line, I, as well as others, were probably responsible. We dropped the knowledge off and just started calling it nature of science. And I think that's responsible for people still misunderstanding the distinction between nature of science and inquiry. They put them together. And so we've now gone back to saying nature of science are the characteristics of the knowledge that are directly derived from the way we develop the knowledge, which is inquiry. And but I think the phrase nature of science is too vague, and I think it was unintentionally made that way when we dropped the knowledge off way back. So I'm not happy about the misunderstandings. That's still in the literature. A lot of studies, this meeting, there's a theme or a strand called nature of science. Sometimes it's called a history and epistemology of science. But if you look at the papers in the strand, 90% have nothing to do with nature of science. They're more about inquiry, and some of them are about, I don't even know what they're about. And so people are still having problems understanding what it actually is. So I'm not happy with that. I'm not happy with it not really happening in student classrooms. It doesn't show up on most assessments, which are the things that really affect, you know, if it's going to be on a test, then the teachers will pay attention to it. So maybe in the future that'll happen. So I'm not happy with that stuff. I'm happy with the progress we've made in our group. I'm just not happy overall in general, which is the more important thing. In terms of the biggest problem right now, or where we're at, I still can't figure out how you get a teacher to value nature of science. So I think I can teach them nature of science. I think I can teach them how to teach it. But we have trouble getting them to go and do it after we're not around. If they're in a grant of mine and I'm always watching them, they'll do it and I require them to do it. But they don't value it as much as the regular content, and so it doesn't get implemented like it should. I'll have teachers that are in workshops that really do, or in grants, and they do a great job, and then the next year they're not doing nature of science. And then 5 years later, I'll get a phone call, and this person is teaching a whole course on nature of science in his high school. And why that happened, who knows? I'll have a person that's in a project of mine that I'm saying, this guy doesn't understand anything. He doesn't understand how to teach it. I've been a failure with this guy. And then a year later, he's teaching nature of science. Well, he's asking for activities. So there's something that gets people turned on that is the critical thing now, because unless teachers value it, they're not going to teach it no matter what. And that's what we're trying to figure out, how to get teachers to value it. We think that if we can show them that the way you teach nature of science involves certain instructional practices that are motivational to students. And I think that teachers react to, if their students are enjoying the learning experience, teachers are more likely to do that again. And if they see that the kids enjoy learning about nature or science, they'll do more of it. The other assumption that's still out there and would be the easiest thing to motivate teachers is that nature or science supposedly will enhance students' learning of subject matter. And that's a big assumption that's out there. Roz Driver, I think, first said it. There isn't much research to support that assumption.
Mm-hmm.
We talk about it in our workshops to try and sell the teachers on it, but it's not clear at all that if a student understands nature or science, that it will help them understand the regular science content. So
mm-hmm.
that's another place we're at
mm-hmm.
right now.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't want to interrupt you, but like, speaking of dropping a word, the knowledge word, and I realized from my own work that we don't use the word theory much. Like, it is only restricted to, like, mostly to the theory of evolution.
Okay.
And like, it is like, there is no theory in physics or in chemistry. And like, what I'm thinking, I teach physics at the university level for prospective
mm-hmm.
teachers. And I'm emphasizing them that like physics 101 is the theory of mechanics.
Okay.
And like the physics 102 is the theory of electricity and
mm-hmm.
magnetism.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't get to see that word
mm-hmm.
much
mm-hmm.
and that affects their understanding of what theory is and what the law is and how the theory includes all of the things like as an umbrella term.
Okay.
You know, like
yeah.
includes
something with
laws,
the
experiments, yeah. examples, hypotheses, and everything.
Is it something with the translation of that word into Turkish or
no? We use
because I know in some Asian countries they don't have a word for theory,
oh.
so it causes problems.
We have both a Turkish word, genuine Turkish word, which is Kur'an, and we also use theory
okay.
for theory.
Okay,
and there's no problem of that kind. But like even in if you go to check and physics textbooks, university level physics textbooks. It's just physics,
yeah.
fundamentals of physics.
Yeah. Okay.
It is the theory of physics. And it is like as if you have a theory, it is not so much of a good thing.
So
but in science,
yeah.
it is the goal of science to have
so
a theory.
It's a colloquial
yeah.
uses versus the,
yeah.
yeah.
I mean, we dropped that, it seems like we dropped that word altogether. And in my opinion, it affects people's understanding of nature of science during their learning.
Yeah. There were people at AAAS, when I used to do a lot of work with them, Project 2061, and they were, they didn't want to do anything with the theory law that we do. And they would always say, you know, and they're right, scientists don't sit around in their labs and say, you know, Fatih, what you have there is a good theory. It's not a law, it's a theory. No, I think I have a law. They don't even use that. They talk about what they're doing, and they know how much is inference and how much is directly observable. But my point was always to the general public, to the general high school graduate student, high school graduate. They hear these words. They're in the books in our schools. The theory, the evolution and creationism thing is, you know, the creationists always say it's just a theory. So from a practical standpoint, from a consumer of science, I think it's very important that they. Those words are there. If it was
yeah.
up to me, the words would be gone.
Mm-hmm.
But they are there. And so they have to understand the scientific meaning of these things and what it means, why is one thing a theory and another thing is a law, and what is their relationship.
Yeah.
And so we have not dropped it. It's one of the tougher things for the teachers that we work with to learn. They really have a hard time with that. And I think...
I wasn't saying that we don't use the word, but...
They weren't saying it.
Yeah, it is important to have them in the course titles and
mm-hmm.
book titles.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
When we use the word, oftentimes we use it in a misleading way.
Right.
You know,
okay.
But the appropriate way should be on the book titles,
yeah.
you know, and like for example, I'm a physicist by training and I did my master's on superconductivity and until 1957, there was no theory of superconductivity, but there were laws of physics out there. But the theory was built by using those laws.
Mm-hmm.
And Bardeen, Schaeffer, and Cooper won a Nobel Prize. We are
mm-hmm.
in Sweden now. And in 1972. And their paper was titled the theory of superconductivity. And it happened that in 1986, two scientists in the IBM labs in Zurich, Bethnors and Müller, they found a class of material which didn't fit in that theory. And now everybody is looking for a new theory of superconductivity, which is more general. Mm-hmm. So we need the theories, and we are looking for them always as scientists. You know, it is the best thing to have a theory.
Yeah, there was a college biology textbook that was written by, when I was at Oregon State, three of the biology people that were teaching the general biology, and they wrote a textbook that was very much filled with history of science, but it took the view that you were just talking about, that science is problem solving and theory development, and everything was framed in terms of testing and developing theories. It was really a good college textbook, but it's out of print now because no one would buy it. It didn't look like, you know, the regular one, and then the publisher stopped publishing it. No one's buying the book. Mm-hmm. So they tried. That was the best effort I've seen, but it didn't work.
Okay. Today, do you think the NOS research draws attention that it deserves?
Well, that's an interesting one, because I'm going to say it draws a lot of attention. I'm not going to say this, it's going to sound funny. I'm going to say it's getting too much attention. The reason I'm saying that is there are many people that haven't really thought about and read about nature or science. But because it's a popular area.
Or the philosophy
area,
of science first.
But it's a popular area.
And the history of science.
Right. Yeah. And so many people in science ed, either because of pressures to publish or whatever it is, they
looks
see an
like
area,
a fruitful area of research,
and they do stuff that is like it's disconnected with the prior research because they haven't read it. It's not well founded in terms of what other people are saying nature or science is, and so I think a lot of the attention it's getting, it is getting a lot of attention, has led to some people coming into the area that are just doing really bad stuff, and so that's why I say maybe it's getting too much attention. But we have other areas in science ed, and it's one of the things that's strange about our discipline is where researchers that jump around and don't have a focus, because we don't, answers to questions don't come quickly, and they just jump around from topic to topic to topic. That'll be in my talk today also. I'm going to call it being entrepreneurs rather than sticking to things that are really meeting our ultimate goals instead of just jumping around. So on one hand, I would say it's getting too much attention. On the other hand, everybody knows about it. It's very visible, but the research is not translating into practice by teachers.
Okay. How do you see the future of the nature of science research?
I think it'll continue to grow, and I think that's great because I think it's one of the difficult things to teach. I think it's one of the more important things to teach. Not necessarily because those assumptions that are out there that's going to help you make better decisions or it's going to help you. But I think if you're studying science, and science is important, students should know science and how science is different than other disciplines, and they should know the ground rules and the limitations of the knowledge. And I think it's important for that, especially for consumers of science. So I think we'll continue that way. I hope that the future will build on what we now know. And in the chapter in the handbook, I had, I think, 19 research questions. We need to find out, there are many ways of being explicit about nature or science. Is one way better than another? Are they all equal? Should nature or science be embedded within the content, or can you pull it out and do it separately? Is nature or science different from one discipline to another? The little bit of research on that shows that it's not. Although the general opinion, if you go around this meeting, is people would say, oh, there are natures of science, and biology, nature of science, is different than chemistry, is different than physics. But when you get chemists, physicists, and biologists together, and you ask them about these things, they all agree with it. So there are small distinctions, but there are many more common threads that run across the disciplines. So I hope we continue to investigate those things, and I think we will. I think more and more people are getting into nature of science. And so I think we'll move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can't complain about that. I think we have a bright future.
How is the international contribution, like from other geographical regions and cultures?
That's really increasing.
Hmm.
I mean, individuals like yourself, there's people in Taiwan, there's people in Hong Kong now. It's definitely international.
Okay.
I would add, you know, it's almost, this may or may not be true. It seems to me that if I were to say, is most of the nature of science research done in the U.S. or internationally? I'll just divide it U.S. versus everybody else. I think there's more being done outside the U.S. right now than is in the U.S. I think originally when it started, it was the whole U.S. thing. But there's a lot of it all around the place. I mean, I have not gone anywhere in the last 3 years where nature science was not a prominent interest, and there are people that are actually doing work. I mean, I go around and do workshops all over the world, but wherever I go now, there's always some group or individuals that are already working on nature science and writing grants, and you know, and I find more and more about that every day.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's very big internationally.
Yeah. And my last question is, what suggestions do you have, especially for young researchers?
Oh, okay. I tell my students and anybody that ever asks me for advice at a meeting to find an area that's really interesting to them and focus on that area. And if you find two, that's okay. But you need to have a focus and you need to have a line of research where you're continually building upon the knowledge you and other people in that area are interested in and not jump around. You really become an expert. So when someone hears your name, they immediately associate it with whatever it is that you're doing. And that's how you become an advanced scholar in an area. You can't be an expert in everything. I'm gonna review the various chapters in the handbook today, but there are 31 chapters, I think, maybe 30, I'm not sure anymore. But there's, you know, it's maybe five that I would consider myself very knowledgeable in. You know, I know a little about the other ones. The advantage of doing the handbook was I got to know a lot about all kinds of areas that I normally would not, because I would never read those articles. But pick an area and really focus on it. And always think about what are the assumptions in that area. And don't just accept them.
Mm-hmm.
Test them.
Like for starters of nature of science research, what would you say?
Well, I'd start with that. I would have them read a lot of history and philosophy because I would want them to know where these things that people are talking about today came from. You know, it wasn't that Norm just came and listed these seven things, which some people think he just made up these seven things. There's a reason why we have those seven, and it was there's a much bigger list you could make, and we rely on those seven for practical reasons, but all the things we talk about are not ideas we came up with. I mean, Kuhn talked about them, Lakatos, Loudon. I mean, there's a rich history of all these, yeah. And so they should do that reading. Then I would have them read a good historical summary, one of the reviews of research. So they can see where there are gaps, what the assumptions are, what still needs to be done. And that would be a good foundation to then have them do their own thing.
That's the whole purpose of taking graduate courses, I guess, right?
Yeah, yeah. And so that's what I would do. Because again, the biggest problem I see, and it's not just nature science, but I'll come to a meeting and you go to a session and it's very clear, or I read an article I'm reviewing, it's very clear that the person has not read any of the work prior to their own work. And so what they're doing is doesn't fit into the context of what's out there, what's known, doesn't fit into the context of what we need to know. Very often it's just like, we're doing it again. You know, this has nothing to do with nature science, but I was talking to, who was it last night? It was someone from Germany. But we saw this misconceptions, and he said he's getting sick of hearing this research on misconceptions about electrical circuits. It's misconceptions about electrical circuits in Germany, then there's another one from Malta, then there's another one from Cyprus, and here's one from Italy. And we don't need to do this. We already know what these misconceptions are, and there's no reason to believe that in these different countries it would be different. Sometimes it does make sense. Nature science might be one because If it's related to people's worldviews, different cultures and countries, you need to do that to see if it's really the same everywhere else. But, you know, people just need to build on what's out there and not reinvent the wheel when they don't have to. But if something's being done in a way that's assuming things that you can identify and here's a problem, and you look at it another way, that's fine. But be familiar with the literature in the field that you're interested in. So that can be my big message.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.
And I appreciate it.
Okay.
All right.